Hi, I'm Frances Anderton. Thank you very much for listening to DNA. Just like the designs we spotlight on DNA, great care and creativity is taken in producing the stories on Unfictional. Intimate storytelling and artful documentaries crafted by some of the most talented radio producers across the world. Check it out, you'll enjoy it. Find Unfictional on KCRW's iTunes page. Hi, I'm Frances Anderton, and you're listening to DNA.
To all who come to this happy place, welcome. Disneyland is your land.
60 years ago, on July 17, Walt Disney himself welcomed the first visitors to Disneyland Park, built on orange groves in Anaheim. This past weekend, hundreds of thousands of people descended on the park for the start of Disney's Diamond Celebration. So what keeps Disneyland eternally young? And why is a huge World's Fair now on in Milan barely raising a murmur?
It's an astonishing new city that's been built just on the outskirts of Milan, next to the Fiera, to the big trade show. It's incredibly under-recognized in the U.S.
James Bieber will tell us why coming up. He designed the U.S. Pavilion at this year's Milan Expo. We'll also talk to filmmaker James Cameron about applying storytelling to solar energy. First, though, let's go back to the summer of 1955. And if you turned on ABC on the afternoon of July 17, you would have gotten the first taste of a magical and highly nostalgic experience.
She gets ready to start on her maiden voyage. The Mark Twain, a proud symbol of that romantic era when whole cities grew out of river ports. And this is Frontierland. Inside this stockade, Walt Disney has created a frontier village that could have been carved out of the wilderness 100 years ago by the pioneers themselves.
This is Ronald Reagan again, and I'm very happy now to show you these young people. Since Disneyland opened, these children have been eagerly waiting to cross the moat for a wondrous trip through the Disney imagination. They'll be the first children to enjoy the Fantasyland rides, every one of which recreates the adventures of characters Walt has immortalized in films.
Yes, you heard it right. It was the Gipper himself reporting for ABC from the opening of Disneyland. And it's a reminder that the park in its heyday was intended as a trip around exotic places, a little bit like a World's Fair. It was an idea, says longtime Disney reporter Jim Hill, that came to Walt when he arrived in LA and was trying to interest Universal Studios in his animation.
And Universal had just opened Universal City at that point, which was, you know, the first time a giant production facility with outdoor sets and that sort of thing. And Walt showed up, and on the first day, showed his newsreel card, and the guy was like, "Well, this is nice, but we don't really have a job for you." But so Walt then decided, "Well, you know, maybe I'll learn a few tips about directing by sort of haunting sets around that." And so he then went back for the next 3 days, you know, wandering from the sets of The Hunchback of Notre Dame and turning the corner from provincial France to suddenly he's on a Western set. And Walt never forgot anything. And what he remembered was how amazing it was to be in this environment where you could have a fairy tale castle right around the corner from, a U.S. cavalry fort. And honestly, if you want to get right down to it, Disneyland started at Universal Studios.
That's Jim Hill, longtime reporter on Disney. More from him coming up in a moment. So Walt built his park. And as the ABC newscast showed, it was a reflection of its times in all its optimism and its social values.
And there's Aunt Jemima.
In 1970, the company said goodbye to the African-American mammy figure of Aunt Jemima at the Pancake House evoking the antebellum South. Now it's the Rivabelle Terrace. With changing social mores, Disneyland changed. But how has it stood the test of time? Who better to ask than Charles Phoenix? He's a self-proclaimed histotainer and a Disneyland obsessive.
I grew up in Southern California, and I can remember, I've been going there my whole life. I felt superior as a child to our relatives that lived out of state because we had Disneyland and they didn't. But the other thing, to me at least, you know, I always feel very lucky to be there. I think it's a very, very special combination of elements, and it's very different from any other theme park in the world. And it's, you know, in part, it's like a living museum, but more than that, it's a pop cultural juggernaut of the absolute highest order. I mean, it's Disney, a movie studio built a theme park in the 1950s in a way that it had never been done before. I mean, again, that Walt Disney, what a guy.
So Disney's been asking around, getting from people what rides they would absolutely never want to see go. Which would you pick?
Well, that's really tough. My favorite attractions at Disneyland are already gone. The Carousel of Progress was from the World's Fair of 1964 that was imported to Disneyland in 65 after the fair was over. It was there till 74. The Carousel of Progress, America the Beautiful, which was the theater in the round, I mean, a projection in the round, the movie surrounded you, that's gone. But I still love, you know, all the classics. I mean, let's not ever get rid of It's a Small World.
Which, however cliched it might sound, is incredibly brilliant. I mean, the design of that ride is just exquisite.
It really is. It's like a giant arts and crafts project. I mean, it's really the least expensive Disney attraction, it seems, at this point. I mean, there's not a lot of bells and whistles and stuff, but just the magnificence of the color and the art direction is so brilliant. It holds up 51 years later. That ride is 51 years old. But anyway, yeah, that ride, Small World, It's a Small World, or whatever we call it, Small World, was another import from the 64 World's Fair. That was PepsiCo and UNICEF sponsored that. The other one that I wouldn't, so we got those, the Jungle Cruise, the Tiki Room, I mean, you know, Mr. Toad's Wild Ride, the Mark Twain, the train, you know, the teacups, the Storybook Canal, Casey Jr.'s train, Grand Canyon Diorama, Primeval World. When you go around the train at Disneyland, you see Primeval World. That's another import from the 64 World's Fair. That was actually in the Ford Pavilion there. You know, Disneyland evolves, of course. We knew that it would. Walt Disney said that it always would. You know, most of the time it's for the better, I would say. I mean, the trees and flowers and everything are so beautiful at Disneyland. All the trees have grown up so big and everything. It's interesting to watch, you know, Disneyland evolve.
Are there any rides that you'd actually like to see go on its 60th birthday?
I think my thing would be, I think Tomorrowland, you know, they need to kind of rethink Tomorrowland. It's kind of been a stepchild, it seems. Is that not politically correct to say stepchild? I don't want to offend anybody. Tomorrowland. Tomorrowland needs a rethink right now. I mean, it doesn't know what it wants to be. When I was a kid growing up in the 60s and the 70s, without a question, Tomorrowland was the ultimate place to be in Disneyland. I mean, it was that incredible. But, you know, there's so much at Disneyland to see and do. I mean, it's just like, it's crazy. I mean, to try to, and now they have California Adventure, which, you know, kind of started off slow, but now has blossomed into something really important, especially since they built Cars Land there, which is an homage to Route 66, the great Mother Road, the American Mother Road, or the Mother Road of America, whatever you call it. And they did just an incredible job. I mean, when I first saw it, I didn't want to leave. I'm like, I was plotting immediately. How could I just live here? That's how great it was. And I love the American roadside. I love vintage neon and car culture. I'm obsessed with vintage cars and stuff like that. So it had my name written all over it. And apparently everyone agrees because it's kind of crowded. What can I say?
Charles Phoenix is a pop culture humorist, a historian, and a chef whose work explores and celebrates 1950s and 1960s kitsch and Americana. You're listening to DNA. I'm Frances Anderton. Jim Hill is an entertainment reporter who's been covering Disney's development for years, and he may be just a little bit jaded. We reached him by phone at the Disneyland Hotel following the unveiling of World of Color's new Celebrate. That's the updated version of the hugely popular light and water show at California Adventure. So how was it, Jim?
There was a lot of Walt. You know, it was like they had dug out a lot of archival footage and
It was entertaining in a very corporate kind of way, I guess is the polite way of putting it. So
now you've got a sort of a journalist skepticism, but you've spent a lot of time studying Disneyland. What draws you to study it?
To be honest, I think what fascinates me about Disneyland is, again, there hadn't been one prior to, you know, Walt deciding to build out in this orange grove in Anaheim. But, you know, one of the fun things about covering this industry is there's this, you know, for lack of a better term, there's this weird arms race going on right now between Disney and Universal when it comes to the themed entertainment market. And for Disneyland, they've gone full bore with all of these entertainments in the park where they're doing, for example, tonight they're doing a brand new fireworks show. Before the first shell goes off, guests were standing on Main Street, the lights will go dark, and suddenly they're standing in the orange grove that Walt came to in 1953. You know, the point they're trying to tell in the story is only a Walt Disney could walk out to this dusty, dry orange grove and see, you know, what could potentially become the happiest place on earth. Whereas Universal Hollywood, they have, you know, they're spending big bucks reinventing their tram tour, and next year it's Potter. And just what they've got done so far looks tremendous.
On the Wizarding World of Harry Potter.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So that's going to very definitely appeal to the children of today. Does Disneyland trump every other theme park in appealing to our sort of collective nostalgia for the past because it was the first one?
You know, I'd have to say yes. In fact, that's what's, you know, what's very interesting about the way the Walt Disney Company markets Disneyland. I mean, for the longest time, they were kind of hoping to turn their Anaheim property into sort of Orlando West. But what Disney has learned the hard way is that this really isn't, Anaheim really isn't a destination resort. I mean, don't get me wrong, 30% of the people who come to Disneyland are coming from around the world or the other side of the United States. But 70% of the folks who come to Disneyland are Southern California locals. They come from less than 100 miles away. And Disney now has sort of embraced the fact that what they really have here in Anaheim is the world's most famous regional theme park.
And lastly, do you personally take pleasure in going to Disneyland?
I've been studying this company since I was a kid. And I mean, you'd have to be someone with a soul that was dead not to get some pleasure out of being, you know, in the beautiful gardens and the music and the characters. But at the same time, you know, it's just gotten increasingly, for lack of a better term, formulaic. I mean, Disney these days typically builds a ride that gives you an intense experience for 10 minutes and then exits you through the gift shop.
Jim Hill is an entertainment writer who focuses on Disney's development. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. And now to what may be the biggest show you've never heard of. As we heard earlier, Disneyland got some of its best-loved early rides from the New York World's Fair of 1964. Well, this year there's a World's Fair, although it's called an Expo, and it opened earlier this month in Milan, Italy. Its theme is Feeding the Planet, Energy for Life, and more than 140 countries have created pavilions showcasing ideas for healthy, safe, and sufficient food for everyone. 20 million visitors are expected to attend during the next 6 months. So why has it barely aroused a peep here? James Bieber is the New York-based architect who designed the U.S. Pavilion.
In 1999, legislation was introduced in Congress that forbade the State Department from spending a single penny on the U.S. participation in an expo. So for them, it's a process of gathering proposals and choosing a team to run this and then helping to raise funds privately with corporations and mostly corporations and occasionally individuals. So that process is a lot more complicated and a lot more unusual for the State Department than simply devoting budget. So it does have a kind of ambivalent relationship, and it does have to be convinced. And part of the job, it seemed to us, was that the Italians believe that if the U.S. didn't participate, it wasn't really a World's Fair. You know, it's just a fair. And we're working very hard to convince the U.S. government to participate. It finally agreed, virtually later than any other nation. It's incredibly under-recognized in the U.S. I have to admit, you could put it on bad or inadequate marketing by the Expo people. You could also put it to the U.S. population simply not even understanding what an Expo is. We always have to say, you know, it's a World's Fair, you know, so that, and they go, oh, really, they still do those. And that's the second problem, is that people have no idea that they still do them. 75 million people went to the one in Shanghai, and yet Americans don't have any idea that they exist. And then I guess the question is whether they care even if they know that they exist. And some people consider them to be antiquated or have memories of them being driven by kind of corporate nations rather than the other kind of nation. And so, you know, I'm just not sure what it takes to convince the American public that these are worthwhile. I think that they're it's a sort of a I'd forgotten how much these things are design Olympics, especially now when the pavilions sit right next to each other, practically sharing party walls. There's an intensely kind of close competition about design, and there are some fantastic pavilions there and some really, really funny ones, and I don't think they're intentionally funny. But so the range of design is amazing. The sheer kind of scale of this thing building a city with infrastructure in a couple of years is really astonishing.
Can you tell us one of the really excellent pavilions and one of the really funny ones?
Well, there are a couple that I think are excellent, that, you know, hopefully in addition to ours, and one of them is Brazil. And actually, the best ones have very simple messages. The Brazilian pavilion is a corten, a kind of rusted frame that's enormously long and tall, but now has a mesh in it that you can climb on. So this warped mesh is an incredible attraction. You know, it is really fun, and it is a kind of trip through the jungle canopy, so to speak. I think that that's enough to attract a huge audience, and there's always a huge line there. And then the UK pavilion has this single piece of art, this beehive, sort of steel frame beehive, or a void of a beehive, that sits as a kind of ghostly apparition. And again, it has one very simple message that's easy to get and has to do with bees and their importance in the food cycle and so on. And then there are other pavilions that seem to somehow, how can I put it, misunderstand what an expo is. There's one that has, this was described to me by a gay friend of mine, has the closest thing to a gay disco in its very center that he's ever seen at an expo.
What does he mean by that? When the gay disco, you're saying that it has nothing to do with the theme, which is feeding the world's population?
Nothing that he could divine. and those were his words. Another one is entirely covered in reflective, shiny, polished metal and has a kind of constant singing and performance outside, and really seems to think that Expo is kind of a flashy Las Vegas kind of affair, which, you know, maybe it is at a certain level.
What do you think an Expo is?
Well, you know, from my point of view, and this is, of course, tainted by what I do, I think it's a design exposition. You know, I think it's an identity parade. I think that nations trying to figure out who they are in a building and in an exhibition, and that to me is so interesting, good and bad. I think it's an amazing display of what nations think of themselves. And inevitably, like any sort of self-examination or therapy, the unintended result is that you really do get a sense of who they are, wittingly or unwittingly.
You just heard from James Bieber. He's designer of the U.S. Pavilion at the Milan Expo 2015. You're listening to DNA. I'm Frances Anderton. Dan Ostroff is a film producer and design scholar who's just published an Eames anthology of film scripts, interviews, notes and speeches by Charles and Ray Eames. His passion for their work started in childhood when he visited the IBM pavilion that they designed at the 1964 New York World's Fair, for which Dan's father was deputy commissioner. So I asked Dan, why in his view does Disneyland thrive while World's Fairs have fallen off the radar?
I think it has to do with the clarity of purpose of each. I feel bad because I'm oblivious to this, to the Milan Fair, but there is a responsibility if you're creating something like that to make sure that it connects with people in a way that's direct and immediate to them. Disneyland has a very clear purpose, and people come from all over the world and all over the country, and they go back over and over again. And that's the purpose of pleasure. And that's what Disney is all about. And it has some added values in addition to pleasure. It celebrates in stories that have good values. And I can see why Disneyland thrives now and why it thrives into the future. As for a World's Fair, I'm not sure who it's for and what its purpose is in the 21st century. We have so many ways for people can learn, and travel isn't as expensive as it used to be. So why is there a 2015 World's Fair? The fairs of the 19th century and the early 20th century were glorious because they shared in a concentrated way information that wasn't readily accessible in another way. But there was something else, which is they weren't designed fairs. So if you went to the 1904 Expo, the people who did the sheep shearing exhibition were sheep shearers. If you went to the 1876 Expo in Philadelphia, these were Easterners who had never been west of the Mississippi, and they met real Apaches. What eventually seems to have happened with fairs is that there was this huge discontinuity between the people making fairs a pretty thing to see and people making the experiences of the fairgoers meaningful.
Now, Dan, your father worked with Charles and Ray Eames on the creation of the IBM Pavilion for the 1964 World Fair, but he also knew Walt Disney, correct? And I think you said your father admired him
He admired Charles and Ray Eames even more. But something we've all forgotten, but my father knew well and Charles and Ray knew well. And I had the pleasure of experiencing a bit before I got too old, which was the circus with the Pueblo Indians. It's the clowns who go with the Kachina dancers. In France, the wandering minstrels. That every society has had a circus. And I think that the positive benefits historically of the circus is what Disneyland brings to us 365 days a year. It's a small world
after all. Dan Ostroff is editor of An Eames Anthology. Read about the book on DNA's blog. You're listening to DNA. Coming up after this break, why can't solar panels be pretty too? Listen up to filmmaker James Cameron on bringing storytelling to energy delivery. There is just one moon and one golden sun, and a smile means friendship to everyone. Though the mountains divide and the oceans are wide, it's a small world after all.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW Radio.
Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. Arrays of rectangular solar panels are popping up on roofs and south-facing walls all over the Southland. But do you sometimes wonder if they could just be a little more interesting to look at? Well, one person who thought so is the director of the two highest-grossing movies of all time.
Jim Cameron. We are at Muse School, Muse Elementary School in Malibu, and we're standing near the solar sunflower, which is, 28-foot tall tracking solar array, of which we have five on campus, and it looks like a giant flower. It's designed to be kind of a functional work of art, if you will.
Does the flower shape of it in any way impact the technology and the functionality?
Not really. It's just about getting solar panels arrayed so that they face the sun and track with the sun. But by putting them in that radial pattern so that they look like the petals of a flower, it makes a kind of cognitive connection to what it means. Solar is good for the natural environment, good for biodiversity. You know, it's going to cut down on climate change. And so you look at it, and a flower is kind of a symbol of life, symbol of nature. And so there's a kind of unity of form and function that I think appealed to us when we started on this project.
us being you and your wife, Susie.
Right. My wife, Susie, and her sister, Rebecca, founded the school, I want to say 9 years ago. And we had been intending to put in solar because the school is a green school, and a message to the elementary kids, and now there's a high school as well, is, you know, that we have to be responsible. We have to be responsible stewards for this world that we live in.
Now, you were a student of physics. Did you put this together in your workshop?
No, I didn't do any of the structural or electrical engineering, but I did the initial design. I basically drew it out. I did the power calculations. I knew that off the shelf you could get the tracking bases and so on. Sonnen was our provider on that technology. So, you know, I mean, I kind of, as a filmmaker, I bridged the gap between engineering and new technology on the one hand, and kind of art on the other hand, if you will, art and storytelling. And for me, this is kind of in my wheelhouse that way, because it's a piece of functional art, it's a piece of technology. It also kind of tells a story at a very kind of deeper symbolic level, you know. So, yeah, it makes sense to me.
Now, I understand you've put this out for open source access. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's not out there right now. We just got our patent application in a couple days ago, and the purpose of the patent application is so that somebody can't take it and monopolize it, because we want it to be open source globally. We'll present all of the engineering work online, because a big cost for us of putting in these five sunflowers was the non-recurring engineering costs. So we can eliminate that from somebody else's budget. So rather than do a few hundred that we provide, hopefully there could be thousands of these things around the world if people are inspired by the design.
It certainly is inspiring, and one does look at it and think sunflower farms,
yeah,
akin to wind farms. Is that
sure.
In your imagination?
You could. I mean, there are big farms with tracking arrays. They tend not to be very aesthetically pleasing. They're usually just rectangular. I think the idea here was incorporating solar into landscape architecture, into community centers, into school campuses, and so on, science centers, things like that, so that people see solar as part of their lives. And I wanted to make that subconscious connection between the technology, the solar technology, and life, the flower being a symbol of life or nature.
Now, this is an example of distributed networks of energy, and
sure.
you yourself obviously are also so known for your exploration having to do with water, and there's now more conversation about localizing our control of water. Do you feel that's the future?
I think it could be a big help. I mean, everybody's got a roof. You've got rain gutters. You could do local water catchment. You could have your own cistern. You could have integrated networks of cisterns. And I think this is where it needs to go. People are going to have to take some local responsibility, and not, especially in California, but you could do this everywhere, and stop thinking about the water coming in from hundreds of miles away, because that's maxed out. It's all spoken for. There's only so much water in the Colorado River.
Do you feel that this is like a pivotal moment for the state in terms of energy?
I think it's a pivotal moment for the human race right now, and we need to really fundamentally change the way we do things. And yes, innovation will be a big part of it. I'm a little nervous about innovation, because the more we're constantly impressed by what technology can do, the less responsibility we're individually willing to take in terms of living differently, eating differently, and the things that we need to do, because there's this sense that the techno cavalry are going to come over the hill and save us. But the more we delay taking responsibility for climate change, energy use, water footprint, you know, carbon footprint, all that sort of thing, the bigger and more heroic those giant technology projects are going to have to be, right at the same point that our economy is getting severely damaged by the effects of runaway climate change and resource depletion, all that sort of thing. So we may not be able to afford that techno-optimist solution, if it ever is proven out. I mean, carbon sequestration hasn't been proven at scale. You know, all the things people are talking about are just ideas. So I think the answer is distributed at the level of the individual. We just need to change how we think.
You heard from James Cameron talking about the solar sunflowers designed for Mew School. Read more about them on our website. Also, check out information about the Los Angeles Design Festival and Dwell on Design, both launching this week. There is tons of stuff going on. On Sunday morning, I'll host a discussion about the future of downtown. That'll be at Dwell on Design, hosted by the Association of Women in Architecture. Again, check our website for the details. That's it for today's show. DNA is produced by Caroline Chamberlain and mixed by Ray Guana. Special thanks to Jason Groman. Find more DNA on our blog at kcrw.com/DNA. And follow us on our Facebook page at KCRW's Design and Architecture. I'm Frances Anderton. Thank you very much for listening.